No, I love it when a plan comes together. We couldn't have done a more coordinated presentation if we'd tried, and we didn't try. So that's the good news. There are a whole bunch of things that have changed with regard to AMEs and QMEs, but I think probably the thing that I find most interesting about it is that under the new law, we have something that we've never had before, criteria. An artificial system, whether it's ACOM for treatment or the AD's regulations when they come out, or the AMA impairment guides for criteria for determining the impairment ratings to be translated into permanent disability. We have, for the first time, criteria. The goal of this system, purportedly, reputedly, presumably, for all these changes, is to decrease the subjectivity of the assessments regarding medical necessity for care, and move instead to evidence-based, peer-reviewed, nationally recognized standards that the Commission on Health and Safety and Workers' Compensation was instructed to study and provide us with. Now, there are 135 of you in this room, and we can probably get 250 opinions on how good a job they did. That's not our issue. That's a political issue. I don't live in the political arena. I live in the real-world arena of trying to handle cases on a day-to-day basis. And what we want you to understand is that we've moved from I think, I believe, and in my experience to a very simple thing. These are the new artificial rules that we're asking you to apply. Your last 30 years of artificial rules that we've asked you to apply, I believe, are gone. We have a whole new set of artificial rules that we're going to ask you to learn. Buy the books. Take the classes. And apply them for us using good, solid medical decision-making that's supported by evidence-based, peer-reviewed, nationally recognized standards that relate to two things. What is efficacious treatment as opposed to what's a waste of time? And what is the objective basis for an impairment rating under a system that none of us probably agree with? There's nobody in this room, I suspect, who would have adopted either the ACOM guidelines or the AMA impairment system. Nobody. As is, would have adopted those. They are a political compromise. So with that in mind, what we're asking you to do is change your entire mindset, because there's no longer such a thing as an applicant revaluation or a defense evaluation. It used to be each side got to pick their gladiator as a lawyer, each gladiator got to pick their gladiator as a doctor, and we went to war. It doesn't happen that way anymore starting in January. There is no longer going to be the truly historic adversary medical legal evaluation. We are counting on you all to adopt this standard of evidence-based medicine, of nationally recognized standards, of objective criteria for medical decision-making, as opposed to I think, I believe. I've always felt the difference between an applicant's evaluator and a defense evaluator was a very simple thing, assuming everyone is being honest. The defense evaluator says, prove it, and the applicant's evaluator gives him a hug and says, I believe you, dear. That's the difference. Fundamentally, when they're being honest, that's the difference. When they're being dishonest, different issue. But we can get wide variations there. So what's really changed with regard to the adversary nature of the applicant QME, the defense QME, is very simple. We're going to have a first opportunity to select an AME who need not be a QME when there's a dispute. Those of you who can qualify as AMEs, in our judgment, what are we going to be looking for? We'll be talking about that throughout the course of the day. But we have some ideas that we'll be telling you about later on of what we think from the applicant side, from the defense side, makes someone into an AME. But the system itself is moved in that direction. Now, very simply, we're going to have medical provider networks. What that means, I don't know. I've never seen one. I've heard everything from it's going to be one doctor to 100 doctors. I've heard everything it's going to be every defense hack or every applicant's crazy person as the panel. I don't know. I've had a couple of clients say, frankly, I don't care who's in my medical provider network. That seems to be the rational approach. I don't care who's in my medical provider network. You know why? Because we have objective criteria against which we're going to base your recommendations and whether we do or don't authorize them. So it really shouldn't matter who's in the network, and many of my clients are saying that. I don't care, because I'm going to apply the same evidence-based, peer-reviewed, nationally recognized standards to deciding what to authorize and what not to authorize, so it doesn't make any difference who you were in your past life as the physician. You're all going to get in. That solves a couple of problems. The biggest one is access to patients and care. Now, when treatment is provided in that network, we have a new process that starts next year. It's a quasi-AME process. It's a de facto AME process. It's because when the doctor says no and the patient says yes within a medical provider network, they get a second opinion within the network, they get a third opinion within the network, and then they go to independent medical review. That IMR doctor is it. You don't go through the medical legal process at that point. That IMR doctor is it. And the AD was required to review, evaluate, adopt, incorporate, and issue a decision on whether that treatment is medically appropriate. You become an AME if you're on that panel. How many of you are on the second opinion spinal surgery list? Not nearly as many as we need. I saw maybe five hands in the whole room. We need more qualified, board-certified orthopedic surgeons and neurosurgeons, in fact, on that system because they are the second tier of de facto AMEs. Second opinion spinal surgery system, for those of you who don't know, is when the employer or carrier or claims administrator disputes the need for medical necessity for surgery. We don't go through the AME-QME process anymore necessarily. We go directly to the second opinion spinal surgery process. That's one doc that the system is supposed to be relying on to do an expedited review to get this patient medically necessary surgery or to prevent a medically unnecessary surgery, a really important gatekeeper effect. Because what we do know as payors is that first stupidly done medically unnecessary surgery by an unqualified physician leads to 12 more necessary surgeries because of a botched first surgery. We want to stop that first unnecessary surgery. So we want the best minds available using the best medical decision making, using the objective criteria of medical necessity to get the patient what he needs and stop the patient from getting what he doesn't need because we know that when they get unnecessary surgery, it's not generally done well and the outcome's not very good. We need the people to do that. That's the second kind of an AME that we've got. So we've got the IMR, and we've got second opinion spinal surgeries. Now we have AMEs. Now where utilization review denies a treatment request outside of a network, and the treating physician is requesting it, or inside a network if the treating physician is requesting it, where do we go then? We go to the AME-QME process. We go first to an AME. If we can't get an AME, do we get to do what we used to do? Is everybody hire a gladiator and go to war? No. System's not going to allow us to do that anymore. They're going to require us to go to an AME or they're going to force an AME on us. So if we couldn't figure out an AME to begin with, what's going to happen? They're going to send us a panel. Three randomly selected board-certified orthopedic surgeons off their panel. And what we should get is everybody has an opportunity to look at that list and say, boy, that's not who I would have put on it. Well, that puts a premium on the first guy when we should have chosen the AME when we had an unlimited group of doctors to choose from. But now our group of doctors is more limited. We're going to go through the list since we couldn't agree. And they're going to say, here's three. Okay, boys and girls, pick one or we're going to force one on you. So if we can't pick one off the list within a very few days, we're going to have to – I pick the one that I think is the most horrendous doctor on the panel of three and I ding him. Mr. Bloom, the applicant's attorney in my case, will pick the one who he thinks is the most horrendous doctor for his client, and he'll ding him. Last man standing becomes the de facto AME. The third doctor on the panel, who was not booted by either side, becomes the de facto AME. Yet again, in essence, an AME. A delightful process, which is going to do one thing. It's going to encourage us to go back to the drawing board and agree on an AME to begin with so we can avoid getting stuck with last man standing. Least bad alternative should not be the choice of who does your medical evaluation in important issues relating to medical treatment of a patient. The systems are slightly different with represented and unrepresented workers. The system is slightly different with regard to dates of injury, et cetera. But that's where we're going. That's where we're headed. That's where we'll be in a month for most cases, certainly for all cases for injuries after 1105. For all unrepresented workers after April 19th of 04, and for injuries prior to 1105 for represented workers, we'll still get to go to war with our gladiators. That doesn't make it good. It just lets some people kind of finish out their practice with the way they brought in the patients and they brought in their cases. Net result of all of this is what we're hoping to come up with as the result is exactly what our first presenter talked about. Objective decision-making so that we can resolve a dispute. He used the term settle the case. We may end up settling the case. The other term is resolve the issue. I would say resolve our disputed issue, which is does he or doesn't he need the surgery? What surgery perhaps should it be? Is this surgery experimental? Is this drug cocktail of OxyContin times 12 times a day I had a doctor recently write me a nice apology letter saying, I'm really sorry, I've been prescribing OxyContin for the last 2.5 years for this patient who I just did my first random blood test on, and there's no drugs in her system whatsoever. He recommended that she might consider not restarting the medication. He told us that the monthly value of the medication was of almost $11,000 in street value. And he said, I'm not accusing of anybody of doing anything improper. I'm hoping that you all can kind of help us curtail some of this. But just keep in mind, you no longer are an advocate for the patient in one sense. You are no longer an advocate for the applicant in one sense. You are no longer an advocate for the defense attorney or the insurance company, etc. What we're asking you all to do is to become advocates for good medicine using the criteria we give you that's been legislatively mandated upon all of us, regardless of whether you agree with it or disagree with it. If you think it falls within ACOM and ACOM says no, and you believe that there's good, solid, evidence-based, peer-reviewed, nationally recognized standards that say this is the exception, then give us the information. You're going to end up in litigation only under one circumstance under this new regime, and that is if you don't give us the reason for your decision. Cite us the article, cite us the study, tell us why it's a good study, why it applies to this patient, why the ACOM or the other standard doesn't, and this system will actually become less litigious, and in 2 years, maybe you won't see that much of the lawyers. You'll just get to see patients and treat them. And that's what we're hoping is going to be the net result. Thank you.
We'll go on to the please sit down. We'll go on to the next session, and then we'll have save these questions. Although, Michael, I have one question. Does anyone in the room know when a person goes for a spine second opinion, what percentage of those patients are approved for surgery and what aren't? Do we have data on that?
I don't think we know. Most people don't even know there's a list.
All right. And are there any rumors of expanding that to other aspects of surgery, foot surgery, hand? Why not?
Take the mic, please,
Judge Faust. This is Judge Faust. We're greatly honored to have her here. She's really the glue that holds this whole course together because she's the bottom line.
That's too much of a buildup. For one thing, my understanding is that the legislature does not really want to they did no cleanup legislation on SB 899. My understanding was they were sick and tired of it. They're just going to leave it alone. Cheese with the Commission on Health and Safety and Workers' Compensation, we affectionately call it Cheese Whiz, actually is having some concerns about the second surgery opinion. And one concern I have about it is that provision where you can either get a second opinion with an evaluation of the injured worker or one without. And I really have some concerns about a doctor making a recommendation about spinal surgery just on the basis of medical records without ever speaking to the patient or examining them. I mean, that's...
I didn't know that. So those patients are not examined?
Well, the division, the way they do it is it's $500 if you examine the patients and review the records. It's $250 if you just review the records. And,
right.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, the one problem I have with that is, you know, it's really not the insurance company that's entitled to a second opinion. It's the injured worker, you know,
yeah.
And they need somebody who can help them to make the best decision to control their own lives.
So we'll talk about this more today. It makes you wonder whether or not a true AME evaluation might not be the best way to have those types of second opinion.
Yeah, actually, I think the way it works is you don't have to examine the patient if you're going to say yes to the surgery. If you can look at the scans, the x-rays, the findings, et cetera, that are given to you, and that burst fracture requires repair, then by golly, you can say yes without examining the patient. The patient has the option, if you were otherwise might say no, to be examined. But I think a yes is the only one that doesn't require the examination. The no may or may not.
Okay, let's move on. We'll have time for talking about this later.
Oh,
you know, we're... let me hold that question, and we'll get you first during our quest session period. You know, challenging times cause us all to have some creative approach to our life. I think partly that's why we're here today. That's certainly typified by Martha Stewart, if you look at the most recent magazine article she has. And so adopting the change always creates opportunity. This is a true story. Apparently she was just caught smuggling parsley in her bra. They thought it was marijuana. That's absolutely true. So anyway, With this issue of adopting the change, I'm incredibly pleased to have our next group of speakers. Keep in mind that the COA knows everything about everyone in the work comp system. And we went to five lawyers, every single one of them agreed, and the five lawyers we asked to participate, at least the COA consider the best and brightest lawyers in Northern California. And it's a real honor for us to have them here because that's whom we're going to learn from along with Judge Faust today. This next session should be a very interesting one. We have two applicant attorneys, John Bloom and Alex Wong, and two defense attorneys, Dana Miller and Richard Jacobsmeyer. And they're going to talk about the differences in the new law from an applicant and a defense point of view. This is a broad topic. We're going to stick initially to apportionment issues and then a causation. John will first talk about apportionment, and that will be answered by Richard Jacobsmeyer, and then we'll get on to the issues of causation. So I'm pleased to introduce John Bloom for this discussion.
Thank you. That was a great introduction, and I think Dr. Pfeffer's reference to this group of attorneys that are with us and Judge Faust as really the cream of the crop in Northern California, with the exception of myself, is true. I know all of these attorneys. I watch what they do. I observe the results they achieve and how they achieve them, and they're just a real heads-up group. Do you need something here? No. I'm one of those low-tech guys that is I'll be fumbling with my materials instead of with the screen. So let me talk a little bit about my original motivation to get into workers' compensation, and then I want to talk to you about this funny little thing called apportionment as my topic. 30 years or so ago when I was coming out of law school, I wanted to participate in a humanitarian-oriented activity in the law. I wasn't sure I wanted to practice law at all, but I was drawn to workers' compensation because of its humanitarian, humanistic type of involvement. And I was also drawn to it because it seemed to me at the time that it was a closed system of benefits to be delivered. It was very straightforward, very much a part of my experience of the golden state called California benefit delivery system. That appealed to me. I started out doing defense work, as a lot of these gentlemen have eventuated doing very successfully. I found that it was way too complicated to figure out how to undo a liberal construction concept that helped injured parties or injured workers. In those years, for 50 years or so, Labor Code Section 3202 required all of us, the judges, the lawyers, the doctors, and the appellate justices, to liberally construe questions of law, and it was applied to questions of fact over time to help manifest the beneficial purposes of the California Labor Code. That was repealed recently with the new Reform Act, as were a lot of other code sections. And I want to talk to you about the before and after concepts in the law of apportionment. One of the things that always delighted me as an applicant's advocate, once I went over to work for injured workers rather than the defense community, was this concept of apportionment. If you had it, if an injured worker had an on-the-job injury, no matter, you know, if they only had one leg left to stand on, if they had been working before their current injury and now they can't work, pretty much the disability associated with the fact that they can't work anymore becomes the liability of the insurance carrier or whoever's holding the bag of liability on the insurance interest. May I read to you what before January 1st of this year was Labor Code Section 4663, which, as I understand it, has been in force and effect for over 30 years. As of January 1st of this year, 4663 of the Labor Code read as follows. Quote, in case of aggravation of any disease existing prior to a compensable injury, compensation shall be allowed only for the proportion of the disability due to the aggravation of such prior disease, which is reasonably attributable to the injury. That code section was largely ignored by the system, in my experience, much to the advantage of my clientele. I wasn't telling anybody about that obvious glitch in the way that the law was applied. But when you take away Labor Code Section 3202, the liberal construction clause, which disappeared earlier this year, and transform the 4663 law as follows, what happens is a Full Employment Act for doctors, and I might add lawyers. May I read to you in relevant part Labor Code Section 4663, now effective April 19th, 2004. It says in relevant part, quote, in order for a physician's report to be considered complete on the issue of permanent disability, it must include an apportionment determination. A physician shall make an apportionment determination by finding what approximate percentage of the permanent disability was caused by the direct result of injury arising out of and occurring in the course of employment, and what approximate percentage of that permanent disability was caused by other factors, both before and subsequent to the industrial injury, including prior industrial injuries. Let's take a look at that. 50% of everything you'll be doing as an agreed medical examiner or a panel QME will be the subject of apportionment. The laws have changed. It's clear that the legislative intent supports a transformation in application of benefit entitlements, and it would appear to me that in accordance with a RAND study that estimates an $11 billion saving to the insurance industry with the implementation of the new Reform Act, which includes this code section and several others, there's $11 billion a year that's going to be saved because in part of this law that we're talking about. It's the concept of causation. For 50-plus years in California, it was unlawful to apportion causation. It would appear that the legislative intent now encourages you in the audience as physicians, we as advocates that promote just concepts before courts of law, and members of the bench to apportion causation. This is a new event in California law. It's not that big a deal unless you happen to be an injured worker, but regardless of which side of the economic struggle one sits on, your pivotal role as AME requires you to consider all factors of causation. I want to talk very briefly about then and now, what's changed. Because some of your causation is still going to be the old analysis. Some may not be. Let me talk about two concepts that Dr. Mandel and I talk every time we go into a deposition or something like that. The concepts of speculation and conjecture. There's a line of case law as long as my left arm that says you're not supposed to guess and you're not supposed to speculate. You're not supposed to participate in conjecture. Actually, you know, if you get into the dictionary definitions of the words speculation and conjecture, they both use the word guess, but then the case law in the old days said no guesswork allowed. More recently, the educated appellate justices that interpret judicial rules suggest that educated guesses are permissible. So you're not allowed to guess unless you're educated. Raise your hand if you're educated in this room. You guys and gals look very educated to me. But as Mr. Marx pointed out, if you feed us as advocates in the system substantive facts or a basis upon which to rest your educated guess, we're going to have a hard time unseating that concept. So then it was illegal to guess or unlawful, and now it's unlawful to guess. You need to use facts to support your conclusions. All right. What were the prior bases for apportionment? There were two. That was the first short code section I read you. This is the old law. Natural progression and pre-existing actual labor-impairing disability. Two concepts. If you had a pathology which was likely to lead to disability at or before the date of the industrial injury permanent and stationary date, that's a valid past basis for apportionment. Also, if you were missing an arm, ab initio, prior to the current industrial injury, that was a basis for apportionment. Now let's take a look at whether those two concepts disappeared in the new law. They didn't. You are expected to point a finger using percentages to factors other than the industrial factors. So those still exist. So what else is new? What else is not new? The law used to say it is unlawful to retrospectively or retroactively impose a prophylactic work restriction. In the old days, prophylactic work restrictions were a valid basis for establishing a percentage of permanent disability of a compensable nature, but you couldn't in 1990 look back and say that back in 1970 that person should have avoided X, Y, and Z movements, thereby creating a retroactive prophylactic work restriction. Case law just simply says it's not lawful to do that. Now, the law says they want you to decide what are all the factors that can cause and contribute to the present level of disability. Well, you might say that if a person has a pre-existing natural tendency genetically or for whatever reason to develop a condition of arthritis, that naturally progressive degenerative condition might have created a disability at this point, even in the absence of the industrial injury. But I ask you this. If you find a patient that has pre-existing capsulitis of the rotator cuff or of the capsule of the knee, and you want to offer the opinion that this pre-existing condition created a vulnerability to greater injury in the face of objective extrinsic trauma that results in disability, I ask you whether or not that previously asymptomatic condition of capsule arthritis isn't actually, when you call it a vulnerability, aren't you actually creating the concept of a retroactive prophylactic work restriction? It was illegal before the new law. As far as I can tell from my present reading, it's still unlawful to create retroactive prophylactic work restrictions. I want to ask you to think about that. I think Dr. Mandel is going to be talking about the concept of vulnerability for a pre-existing condition later in his presentation. So that's pretty much it. This is 50% of everything you're going to be doing. The other 50%, of course, we'll be talking about treatment needs. So I'm going to thank you for now.
Now, good. That's great. That's great. We have, as you know, a lot of time for this session, so these talks are really just to get us going. And I know we'll have a brisk discussion with questions from the audience and comments from Judge Faust. To try to balance out this point of view, I'd like to just introduce our next speaker. It's Richard Jacobsmeyer, I'm told he's certainly one of the great legal minds in California.
I tell people that all the time.
Yeah.
I want to thank the association for asking me to speak. My topic, at least right now, is on apportionment. The position from the defense community is, to a great extent, the applicant's bar has been living in a fantasy world since April 19th, 2004, because the legislature doesn't repeal two of the sections involving apportionment and substantially rewrite the other section, making it completely different, and then write a completely new section in order to come back to the same point. And that's the part that I'm seeing a lot of applicants' attorneys take, is that apportionment to causation still means that if the person didn't have disability before the industrial injury, that you cannot apportion even if they had a significant pre-existing condition. I think that's clearly not what the legislature intended when they wrote this section. So the question is, what do we do with that? And I think from my perspective, the one thing I would recommend is that you not get caught in the middle between warring parties on this. This is a legal issue. Apportionment is a somewhat unique issue in that it's a combination of law and fact that doctors are required to comment upon in every single report. You are now required as a matter of law to always, in every single report, indicate the approximate percentage of the permanent disability that you attribute to the industrial injury and the approximate percentage of the permanent disability that you attribute to other factors both before and after the industrial injury. And the manner in which you make that approximation, and this is an approximation, John talked about educated guess, I think that the legislature, in effect, created a situation where we don't have to meet the same criteria that we used to meet, which was if you can't say that there was disability pre-existing, you can't apportion. I think the legislature is clearly looking for something different. It's actually a maximum law that says that the legislature does not perform idle acts. I suspect it's probably honored more in the breach than in the observance of the legislature, but it's one of the rules that we deal with. You don't change the law in order to make it the same. You change it to make it different. So we have to create a new framework for how we deal with apportionment. We're going to have lots and lots of litigation, as John talked about, trying to decide how to do that. In the typical case for we require physician opinion, I think you probably need to look at it in terms of one of two frameworks. The first being you have somebody who's asymptomatic, has an injury, they have disability. The disability is clearly contributed to by their pre-existing condition. Under the rules that we've operated on for the 50 years before April 19th, 2004, that was a case where you probably, in the vast majority of circumstances, would not apportion. You would only be able to apportion in that circumstance if you could, with reasonable medical probability, state that there would be disability by the time of your evaluation, even absent the industrial injury. An almost impossible task. As an applicant attorney, and I did represent injured workers for 18 years, I think only one time I actually had a doctor be able to make the argument that this individual would have had disability as a result of the natural progression of a pre-existing condition, even absent the industrial injury. And the other 788 times that a doctor made that conclusion, we either ignored it or it did not hold up on deposition. It just wasn't something you saw very often. Part of the reason why the legislature is changing the law is because it was virtually impossible for defendants to meet that particular burden on apportionment. This now requires a lower burden, at least in my judgment, under the new statutes. So I think you take that same individual that previously you would not have apportioned on, and you have to make a judgment, a reasoned, educated judgment that allows you to state with some medical understanding, we require medical information on this, as to how you allocate this disability between the industrial injury and the non-industrial or pre-existing or subsequent causes. Keep in mind, they repealed 4750.5, which was a section that allowed apportionment to subsequent injuries. We've replaced all that framework with this idea that you want to make an approximation on a percentage basis. Prior to April 19th, 2004, if you made a percentage basis, apportionment on a percentage basis, that was another thing we completely ignored. There was substantial case law that basically said you cannot apportion on the basis of percentage. Now you are mandated by statute to apportion on the basis of percentage. I think what we're going to require from physicians is to look at individual cases and develop your own framework for how you're going to analyze this concept. I think you look at things such as the severity of the injury, the severity of the pre-existing condition, the individual's response to the injury, and you're going to put all that into a pot. And then you're going to pull out numbers that are probably, for all intents and purposes, speculation, but we're going to call educated guesses because we have nothing else to work with. And if your position is, I can't make this opinion, therefore I'm going to say it's all industrial, I think the ultimate result is going to be is your opinions are not going to be followed. You know, that's the criteria now for making those decisions requires that you make the hard choices about how you're going to divide this up. And we're going to come to an answer. Now, part of it also is going to be addressed by the issues involved with the use of the AMA guides, because when you start using the AMA guides, where you must describe disability based on things that you can see as opposed to things that you exercise judgment on, to a great extent that's true of the AMA guides. It must be objectively verifiable. It must be reproducible. You must be able to, in effect, see it and hold it in order to describe the disability. It's going to be easier, I think, to say that is caused by the injury or it's caused by something else or it's caused by missed factors and you can allocate because you're going to be looking at very specific causes, very specific measurements. It's going to be a little more difficult than some of the DRE assessments where you have peripheral neuropathies and some of the spinal guidelines, but to a great extent when you're describing things objectively, you'll be able to look at the objective factors and say this came as a result of the injury, it came as a result of the pre-existing condition, we're describing it in some manner in between. The real problem that right now we're having is for the injuries between April 19th, 2004, actually all the cases, because this is effective for all claims, all dates of injuries, even the ones which occurred before April 19th, up until January 1st when presumably we'll have a new permanent disability rating schedule and we will be using the guidelines. It is possible we may not have it on January 1st, but administrative director has made a commitment, said she wants to have it up by April 1st, so we'll know. We'll actually know that by about December 18th or 19th because they have to submit it to the Office of Administrative Law before that time in order to have it available by January 1st. We'll have about 2 weeks lead time in order to know whether we're going to be using the new schedule and using the AMA guidelines. And, of course, you'll be going from the Packard-Thurber book, which is about 70 pages and nice big print and pictures, to the AMA guidelines, which are 600 pages, little teeny tiny print, no pictures, lots of charts and graphs. But your individual framework for how you look at apportionment is going to be the key for whether people are going to be willing to listen to your opinion. And, you know, the situation that Michael Marks and I talked about when we did a program for CWCI on apportionment or on the new law, one of the examples we used was somebody who falls 50 feet off of a scaffolding, lands on their rear end, ends up with 6 compression fractures of the spine, and they had significant pre-existing degenerative disc disease. The reality is that that's pre-existing degenerative disc disease had virtually nothing to do with their disability that's a result of that injury. The injury itself is sufficiently traumatic, and the residuals of it are probably going to be, you know, 100%, maybe at the outside 95%, the basis for the disability. On the other hand, you have somebody who is, as a case I have right now, a lady gets up out of her chair and reaches over to pick up a pencil and is now limited to semi-sedentary work as a result of 2 lumbar surgeries that she's had since then, neither of which seem to work out very well. That's a case where you have to look at it and say, this person had a severe underlying condition, the trauma was relatively atraumatic, and you're going to have to develop a framework of how do I decide how much of this is related to the industrial injury and how much is related to the pre-existing condition. And I would submit that in all likelihood you have to, from a medical standpoint, conclude that that condition is predominantly related to the non-industrial part of that, because the industrial injury simply wasn't traumatic enough to really cause the residuals. And we're now looking at things in different terms. Okay, just a little more. The second, by the way, I mentioned 2 scenarios. The second scenario is a person who is actually symptomatic. They have a condition or they have some symptoms that are pre-existing, and I think that in this scenario and the way that this schedule legislation is written now, it makes it easier for you to make an allocation to disability. Previously, you'd only be able to say that there's apportionment if you could say the symptoms were actually labor disabling, or you could describe the degree of disability. You could rarely ever describe disability in terms of work loss of work capacity unless you get a history that justified it. Since we're not going to be using loss of work capacity to a great extent, and I still think it's difficult to impose a retroactive prophylactic work restriction, I don't think that law has changed. But you can still apportion on the basis of causation, particularly if somebody is already showing some signs of symptoms associated with whatever condition they have, and then you can allocate based on the same factors I discussed. Severity of the injury, severity of the pre-existing condition, reaction of the individual to the injury, and how it impacted their particular condition. And I think each of you individually needs to come up with a framework in order to decide how you're going to make those decisions and start giving us answers. And the other thing I think you need to make certain is you can't just give us a percentage. We can't just have a medical report that says, I think 50% of this is due to the pre-existing condition and 50% is due to the industrial injury, without giving some explanation as to how you came to that conclusion. Your opinion, your ultimate judgment is only going to be as valid as the information that you gave us that tells us how you arrived at that allocation. You must describe some basis, some framework that you've developed and your analytical approach to how you looked at this injury and the pre-existing condition, and describe to us your thought process for saying, I think this is half and half. And it may be as simple as saying they had a significant pre-existing condition. This is a condition which is undoubtedly contributing to the disability. They had a significant industrial injury. It appears to have had a significant impact on this condition. And in my judgment, these things are equally contributing to the level of disability. I allocate 50% to the industrial injury, 50% to the non-industrial disability. As long as we have that discussion and we have some understanding of how you decided it, then I think we can look at your opinion and say that's an opinion that a judge can rely upon as substantial evidence because, again, you're mandated by statute to give us this allocation on a percentage basis. So we'll go ahead and move into the question and answer, I guess.
To plug this Diane's computer in. What we're going to do, Diane, maybe you can work on that one. I have one specific question for the two of you, and then I'd like to hear some comments from Judge Faust, and then let's get online because this perhaps is one of the most important aspects of the day. Let's make it very, very simple. There's a good article that just came out in our top journal of bone and joint surgery that says that plantar fasciitis, heel pain, has a high association. Let's just use the word caused, for lack of a better term right now, but it's a high association or is caused by obesity. Fat people get heel pain much more commonly. It also says that probably, but to a lesser degree, that prolonged standing can contribute to this condition. You know, these are really important issues for my little world of foot and ankle and the work comp. Now, if I see a really heavy person in my office who has heel pain, all right, but they never had it before they started working for Cheapway, you know, as a checker, can I say, well, from this top article that just came out 6 months ago, which is the best of its kind, that I would certainly apportion some of this to their obesity, which is a non-industrial issue. I couldn't do that before because they were asymptomatic, and I couldn't in sincerity say that their plantar fasciitis would have definitely occurred. So if we could just go down maybe 1 second, and then Judge Faust, you can comment on that, and then give us your overall comments. John?
To begin with, I think you can apportion that because it's long been the law of the state of Florida.
Yeah, we have two of them.
How's this one working? It's been long been the law of California that if an a medical condition or a condition of disability arises in the course of employment, merely the fact that it appears during employment does not a work compensable consequence make. You have to have that combination cocktail of arising in the course of employment and suffered or sustained during the course of employment. So it has to arise out of your employment. If you have a predisposition of heavy weight that may be associated with empirical observation with plantar fasciitis, and it shows up when you're standing, and then when you sit down, you have, you know, it disappears. And if you had a sedentary job, it disappeared. I wonder whether or not it's necessarily a compensable consequence. You have to show in the course of employment and arising from the employment, and a transient condition disappears, so you can effectively apportion under those circumstances. But obviously, great minds are going to disagree on this point. And you know, if you think that there are residual disability components or residual impairments that will be permanent as a consequence of the long standing in the course of employment, then you get to apportion in part or whole in accordance with your experience.
I'm surprised a little to hear you say that, because in the past I was always shot down, I was told, when I try to apportion to a condition that was not symptomatic. In other words, they said you take the person as is. Peter Mandel used to say, well, it's the eggshell theory. They happen to hire a fat person. That fat person has lots of problems they could develop, and you can't apportion to their plantar fasciitis that they never had, and we're going to put it all on the fact that they stand 12 hours a day for Cheapway. So I would think that's at least what the applicants were always telling, applicant attorneys were always telling me in the past. But has anything changed in that type of a case between maybe Richard, can you comment?
Yeah,
that's a very sort of more defense position that you're taking than I would think.
I think the doctor's correct. A lot of applicants' attorneys would still argue in that circumstance that unless you can say they would become disabled without the industrial injury, that you would not be able to apportion. I think John's approach is actually correct, and I would actually throw into the mix, again, developing this framework. If you have somebody who is 50 pounds overweight and spends all day long on their feet, and maybe they work overtime on their feet, and they're working on concrete all the time, and they have these steel-toed boots that are really difficult to walk in, then you might say, you know, they're not that overweight. They spend a lot of time on their feet. It's much more traumatic than the average. You might allocate a much higher percentage of that to an industrial injury and less to the weight as a factor, as opposed to it's a case that shortly after this legislation passed, I had a case at the board where we were ready to settle the case. The applicant attorney was demanding $120,000. I think my client was offering $60,000. Under the old statutes, we probably would have paid $100,000 or $110,000 to settle it. I walked down on the day of trial, and I looked at the defense attorney. This is 3 days after the legislation passed. I'm sorry, the applicant attorney, and said, apportionment to causation, and we settled the case for $62,000 because he did not want to send his 5'2", 295-pound client back to the doctor to find out why her feet hurt, because we know why her feet hurt. It didn't have a whole lot to do with her job duties. Those kind of issues became very significant at that point. I think they are now. If you have somebody who's 5'2", 295 pounds, and they spend half the day on their feet, and they develop plantar fasciitis, I think it's unrealistic to say that that's predominantly caused by their work environment.
All right.
They're probably going to have that condition almost independent of work. But once you decide it's work-related, you have to make the apportionment. You have to come up with a framework to decide how the apportionment gets dealt with.
Good. So let's get some comments from Judge Faust, if you'd like, on this, and then we'll just take a whole series of questions. Let her finish, then we'll get right to you and the others.
The problem with my responding to that is, now, unless you're not going
to
do this
anymore. You don't have to respond to my case,
Go ahead. It's just that this sort of gets into what I was going to say about apportionment in the first place. I'll just say briefly that, you know, attorneys have clients to represent. Their clients are not going to be happy if they say, beats me, I haven't the faintest idea. So you've got to come up with an answer. But the truth of the matter is, right now, there are no answers. I mean, there's two factors going here. Number one, we have to get interpretation from the appellate courts. And two, this kind of stuff tends to have a life of its own. So that even with appellate interpretation, it develops into something quite different in the practice. I'll go into it when I talk about, and I have a handout that I think they're going to pass out that sort of explains my view on this situation. I'm not going to belabor the point more.
Fine. You're going to get that handout soon. We're making a copy at the Business Center. Sir.
Hi, I'm Andrew Stein. I'm an orthopedic hand surgeon. I have a question for Judge Faust about 4664. It says, I quote, if the applicant has received a prior award of PD, it shall be conclusively presumed that the prior PD exists at the time of the subsequent industrial injury. So I find myself in situations doing QMEs or AMEs where I will address a whole person impairment after 1105, according to the guides. And I will ask the patient, so do you have any other injuries or workers' compensation claims? Well, when I was working as a self-employed journeyman, I fell off a scaffold and broke my back. So it wasn't a workers' compensation claim. Yeah, I was disabled for 8 years. I qualified for SSI. I went back to work. So when I address, 4664 says only industrial awards.
Can I stop you? Because I don't think 4664 has anything to do with doctors at all, period. I don't think you even have to be concerned about it. It says an award. An award is an award before the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board. What they really meant to say was finding of permanent disability, but they said award. Now, I don't really need a doctor to teach me how to subtract. If they got a prior award of 13% permanent disability, and now this rates out to 30%, I can say 30 minus 13, and I don't think that a doctor has to get involved in that at all. It is a conclusive presumption that affects the burden of proof, whatever that is, but. There is no more, according to the statute, they rehabilitated themselves from the effects of the injury. So I personally don't think doctors even have to worry about that at all. We just subtract it out.
I guess the question I was going to ask was, as functioning as an AME or a QME or even as a treating physician, do we have to address that in terms of whole person impairment?
Well, okay.
Or how would you like to hear about it?
One major problem they're going to have, and they haven't figured this out yet, if you have a conclusive presumption that prior disabilities exist and their prior disability is, say, 25%, now, as a result of the new injury, they have what would have been a 50% disability under the old permanent disability schedule. Now it's a 20% disability. So how do you subtract 25 from 20? And that is a major problem. But again, I don't think it's going to be a problem that's going to concern doctors. It's something the system is going to have to figure out. It says prior award. The award will be of a certain percentage of permanent disability. You are going to say what their present disability is, and we're going to have to figure out how to do the subtraction. I just personally don't think that's the doctor's problem. Well, okay, but overlapping body parts, that is still the judge's problem. That's within the judge's province to figure out the extent of overlap. I don't think if there's a conclusive presumption, doctors have enough to worry about. I don't think they have to worry about this, too, personally.
Yeah actually, the comment I want to make is you still need to comment on apportionment under the approximate percentage standard because you're required to by law, and that's part of the rule. We may or may not pay attention to that if there's a pre-existing disability. A pre-existing award. This is only for permanent disability awards. And one of the questions that the board has been struggling with is, how do we look at compromise and release agreements, and do we apply this apportionment rule? And I think the final answer is we won't because it doesn't make any sense. There's no way to really work that out. So it'll be actual disability awards. The administrative director has come out with proposed rules that say we're only going to subtract apples from apples and oranges from oranges. Old permanent disability ratings from a new rating under the old system, new disability system will only subtract from the new disability system. So we'll separate them out and we'll use the approximate percentage to apportion in the other basis. We also have some rather unique. It may very well be that the apportionment on the basis of pre-existing work restrictions for different body parts is gone because 4750 is gone. So we have other issues that we're going to have to sort out from a legal standpoint. And we've now also divided the body into seven different parts. Okay, we have the bilateral upper extremities, including the shoulders, bilateral lower extremities, including the hips, the spine, the psyche, the visual system, the pulmonary system, and then we have that other body system that includes the heart and the skin and the gizzards and the kidneys and all the other parts. The hearing loss is all going to be thrown into the same part, and you will get apportionment on the basis of those body parts. So you can have a hearing loss, and we may be apportioning to a heart condition.
But you don't have to worry about
that's
that.
Not your
that's
problem.
Not your problem.
We
right.
get to worry about
it. I understand
it,
but yeah, and that, just my last little comment, just because I'm not quite getting the answer to my question, is I don't do back evaluations. Okay, so if this person has a back problem, how do you want to hear about it in the form of my QME about the upper extremity? Do you want me just to mention it? Do you want me to say that a separate QME should be might be appropriate? Is it relevant to you to even know about that if it wasn't an award, even though it was a significant disability? Do you want to know?
I mean, see, in order for me to answer that, there may not be enough time for this now, but I was going to go on after the gentleman and give my view on apportionment, and I also have it contained in that handout, and it's just that I instead of answering a question here, if I'm going to, are you going to have enough time for me after this?
Because
I, you know, I mean, but I was going to do my little, but you have a lot of people there with questions, and if I answer questions, but is there going to be time for me to give my little view on apportionment?
Let's just do this. Let's hold off on this. Let's get through these questions, and then Judge Faust, you can talk to us on apportionment.
Two questions, please. My name is Moses Jacob. One on the previous speakers, on the MPNs. The operative word in the language, as I understand it, is the patient wants a change or is not happy with Dr. A, they may elect to get a second opinion. If they elect not to go to another physician within the MPN, can they automatically ask for the QME at that point, or do they need to go to step 2 and 3 before they get the QME?
You know, I think that's a topic that's going to be covered in a later presentation.
Okay. Two.
That's the medical provider networks you're talking about.
Does anyone know the answer to that off the top of their head? I'd imagine you'd have to. It depends whether you're represented or not. If you're represented and you want to go
it
to
the depends QME. on the basis for the objection, what you're objecting to, and that, and we can probably address that. If there's another topic.
You have the IMR process, too.
So it's not a clear answer.
If it's a disability issue, you get to go to medical legal evaluation. If it's a medical treatment issue, you're in the network.
Yep. So you have to go to the second doctor.
You have to exhaust your three doctors within the network.
Before, two, on the apportionment, I think there's a section in the AMA guides, which are coming in soon, that speaks to a level one disc with very little other findings that may rate out as a zero impairment. Okay. Dealing with this whole subject of apportionment that we're talking about now, how do we handle that when we go into next year's exams? In other words, we're talking about apportioning to some pre-existing factor using percentages. The AMA tells us not to apportion to that because it's a zero impairment. It brings up an interesting dilemma.
Right. You want to try and do applicants work next year? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Blair, do you have an easy answer for that? I'm not sure there is an easy answer for that one.
That's probably something Judge Faust will probably address.
Yeah, right. I mean,
okay. No. We'll get into it.
We'll get it later.
Yeah, I guess I didn't. You were going to talk in summing it up on apportionment. Is that it?
Yeah.
Well, let's have this talk now then, because I think we're being redundant. I didn't realize that's what she was going to specifically discuss.
I have a simple question.
If you anyone who has a question that's not going to be covered,
question,
later, fine.
It's a definition. Will it be impairment or disability after the first? Are we going to use that word?
Impairment only.
After the 1st of January.
Impairment. You'll be describing impairments.
You describe the impairments, and the judges convert it to a disability percentage.
So we won't even talk about disability. Okay.
Right. It'll
this
be
is no longer a disability system effective January 5th.
Unfortunately,
you've got to buy
the AMA book and read through all the minutia.
I am Tony Matten. On the first week of January, I have a whole schedule of QMEs and AMEs. Will every single one of those people get evaluated by AMA guides? Will there be some mix?
Probably none of them will be judged by the AMA guides. It probably won't be impacted quite that because.
No, that isn't true. I said, if you have a stated injury, 1/105 or later, it will be under the AMA guides.
if it's a data entry before 1105, but there's been no opinion regarding permanent disability under the old system, you will still use the AMA guides.
So what Mr. Miller is saying is Labor Code Section 4660 is very specific on that point. And it says that if an injury that occurs prior to January 1st, 2005, either has a comprehensive medical opinion report describing factors or a care provider, meaning a physician, and I interpret that as a primary treating physician, has somehow declared that there is permanent disability associated with the pre-1105 date, then the current disability schedule applies. I also understand that that means that effective January 1st for injuries prior to that date, the new schedule will apply for those injuries that have not been yet described as either having permanent disability or where there exists a comprehensive medical report. And please note, and if you'd like, I'll read that code section to you. I have it in front of me. Please note that it does not talk about permanent and stationary status. 4660 talks about permanent disability. So if there's a report, even a one-liner from a doc before January 1st, 2005, which says there is permanent disability, parentheses, irrespective of permanent stationary status, that person has the present schedule.
Maybe, because I actually disagree with that opinion. I think the rest of, I think unless they're permanent stationary, it's difficult to say they have permanent disability. My response to the question was that as a practical matter, while injuries after 1105 will be using the new schedule, and some claims before that date, the cases you're going to see in the first week of January are probably not going to meet the criteria to be using the new schedule because it's either there's a comprehensive medical legal evaluation, and there's actually all kinds of subtleties on that because we may get a comprehensive medical evaluation at the very early stage of the case. It doesn't say a comprehensive medical evaluation under Labor Code Section 4061, which is a permanent disability evaluation. And a lot of cases have lots of comprehensive medical evaluations. So that's one of the things we have to settle. Secondly, a doctor that says that there is permanent disability. And the third thing is that the injured worker has received notice that they're entitled to a permanent disability evaluation, which simply means that the carrier, actually not even they receive it, they're entitled to receive it. So the vast majority of cases you're going to see in the first, probably the first month, even the first 2 months of the year, will probably be under the old system. And unfortunately, you're going to have to rely upon attorneys who can't agree on the time of day to tell you if it's an old system or new system, and they may tell you you've got to do this evaluation under both because we're going to go down to the board and we're going to argue over whether this is the old system. We had thousands of reports issued over the state of California where doctors just wrote a one-liner, as John described, saying, I think that there's permanent disability in this case or I think there will be permanent disability in this case in an effort to retain those cases under the old schedule. I don't know whether that's going to do it. I think the reports that say that there will be permanent disability clearly don't qualify. I don't think you don't get there. A report says there is permanent disability. I don't know if you can say there is permanent disability to the permanent stationary, but suppose they have a back injury and a psychiatric injury, and the back injury is permanent stationary, and it's been described, and the psychiatric injury is not yet permanent stationary. I think that qualifies under the old schedule because you had a description of disability that a doctor gave. So it's not as the statute's fairly clear. The interpretation of the statute, unfortunately, is not going to be clear. But the reality is that you'll have a little bit of a lead time for a lot of these cases. It's not going to be right after the first of the year that you're going to be doing most of your AMA guidelines. It's going to be probably 3-4 months into the year before you really start having to swing, where almost all the cases you'll be seeing will be AMA guideline cases.
All right, let's hear from Judge Faust now, we'll go on with the floor discussion.
Well, maybe I'll tell you what I'll do.
Come on up. Come on down. Door number two.
That last little exchange, which I know is outside of apportionment. You know, I largely agree with everything that both of these attorneys have said, but one thing I want to point out, to a certain extent, they are simply sharing their problems with you, because most of what they both said is their problem, not your problem. If all of this boggles the minds of attorneys, how should we expect a doctor to come up with the legal answer? So in these areas where the attorneys are going to be arguing that this date controls and that date controls and this rule and that rule, that is not your problem. Your referral source needs to tell you what questions they want you to answer. And I'm going to go into this in greater detail this afternoon. But you know, you do not have to sit there and interpret the law. It's hard enough for a doctor to interpret medicine, and then you're supposed to be doing the law too. So if you are unsure, you ask the attorneys to tell you what they want. What questions do they want you to answer? Not apply Labor Code Section 4663, because you know everybody is very busy, and if they can get someone else to do the job, they're going to do it. That's human nature. And so that's why I agree with them, but I think a lot of it is not something that you have to really, really concern yourself about. Now, you know what I did? I picked up the wrong, I thought was just tremendously profound. He said, until we get some guidance from the appellate courts, everybody is right. And there's a lot of truth in that. We don't know how this is going to pan out. You know, if you look at the series of cases going on apportionment, going back into the 20s and 30s, California started out with apportionment to causation. That, for you attorneys, that Tannenbaum case, if you read it from something like 1935, is nothing but apportionment to causation, and the Court of Appeal chipped away at it over the years. So we don't know how this is going to turn out. The applicant attorneys that say nothing has changed, it's possible that eventually it will turn out that nothing has changed after we get all these appellate decisions. But it's anybody's guess what's going to happen. And right now, about the only thing that doctors can do is just go by the literal words of the statute. And that's actually the handout that I passed out is sort of my suggested way that I think doctors can approach apportionment issues. And what I've basically done is I've just taken the dictionary definition of the term, which is about all we can do at this point. Now, you know, one thing I sort of disagree. The old apportionment, I don't think was a function of liberal construction or Labor Code Section 3202. Let me tell you one thing about the law that has not changed. The defendant still has the burden of proof on apportionment. And for those of you that may not be totally clear on burden of proof, I will explain. All it means is who goes first. It's like a tennis game. You know, the one with the serve has to hit the ball over the net initially, and if the one with the serve can't hit the ball over the net, it really doesn't matter whether the other player can hit it back or not. That person has to go first. That's all burden of proof means. The one with the burden of proof has to come forth with enough evidence that if that's all you had to go on, you could say, sure, I believe you, before the other side has any duty to rebut it. In our legal system in general, the one with the yes side of the question as opposed to the no has to go first. For that reason, applicants have the burden of proof on such issues as industrial injury, were they disabled? Defendants have the burden of proof on apportionment because they have the yes side of the question. Otherwise, you're going to put an applicant to the task of saying, let's see, and I didn't have any pre-existing disability because of automobile accident, slip and fall, no birth defects, no, I mean, you could go through the whole list and not miss something. So defendants have to prove it. Now, burden of proof is generally not that terribly important where there is evidence on both sides, because a judge can look at the evidence and decide which person's evidence is more persuasive. Where it becomes important is where you have a question that can't be answered. If you have something where the only reasonable answer to the question is, I don't know, then the one with the burden of proof is going to lose. And that is why defendants lost under apportionment under the old rules so much. Not necessarily a matter of liberal construction, but there were many apportionment questions, and the real question was what disability would they have had if they hadn't gotten hurt at work, and it was just way too complicated. It would be like one of you trying to answer the question, where would I be sitting at this very moment if I had never gone to medical school? Could you answer that question? No. The answer is I don't know. And that was the case with so many apportionment things. Now, we are still going to have that to a certain extent. And as these cases pan out with the Court of Appeal, I suspect that you are going to have some things go back to the old way. Now, I think that the biggest question right now is the business of apportionment to pathology. You know, apportionment to degenerative arthritis, apportionment to spondylolisthesis, this sort of thing. Do I believe that the legislature intended to create an apportionment to asymptomatic pathology? Yes, I do. Do I think that they're going to get it past the Court of Appeal? In a lot of cases, no, I don't. I mean, it is going to be probably a poor public policy to take two people who have the same job, they're the same age, they had the same type of injury, same length of treatment, everything is identical with them, and now we're going to tell one, but you're getting half as much money as the other one because we ran you both through x-rays and we found some bone spurs on your cervical spine. So now you get half as much as the other one. That is going to create some problems, and I have some doubts that that will actually get past the Court of Appeal. However, until we have guidance, we have to take the statute at face value. And it's really, in many ways, a very fuzzy statute. And, you know, somebody has to cue me on the time because I forgot to look at what time it was when I started speaking. So I wanted to see where you were, Glenn, because I know that you will do that. Now, it's not even clear what is the cause, what they mean by a cause of a permanent disability. Now, I do think that we can assume that the cause has to have some medical connection. I mean, I don't think otherwise. You know what's the cause of every injury? That they were born, that they went to work there, that they went to work that day. If they'd stayed home, they wouldn't have gotten hurt. So you have to deal with some kind of a medical cause. And I've listed in the handout various possibilities for causes. You have trauma, disease, pathology, risk factors, emotional or physical stress, toxic exposure. And I do think that you, until we get some guidance, no matter if it seems silly to you or not, you are going to have to go through those and decide what percentage, you know, you may be able to apportion in terms of the actual cause of the disability. Now, where I think there's a big gaping hole in the statute is I think there's going to be some situations where there will be an obvious, at least partial cause of the disability, but there is no way under the sun that you are going to be able to figure out how much, what kind of a percentage that contributed. A lot of the asymptomatic pathology, didn't they do that study where they pulled all these people off the street in their 40s and said they never had back pain and ran them through CAT scans and found everything from perfectly clean up to, you know, frank herniated discs. So it may be very difficult for you in some of these pathology cases to make an apportionment. Yet, the statute says that you have to do it. And if you don't do it, your report is not complete on the issue of permanent disability, which I can only take to mean substantial evidence. You know, so they're actually putting you to, in some situations, an impossible situation. Now, the way I would suggest that be approached, you don't have to take the suggestion, I may be wrong, but I think that if the statute says you have to assign a percentage, you assign a percentage, and then you say, I did this to comply with the statute, and my opinion is speculative. I mean, that's an honest answer. I mean, I don't know what else you can possibly say. If you're speculating, normally you would not want to speculate. But if they say you have to do it or else you have to send it to somebody else to do the job, if they set you up for an impossibility, you know, you just have to do your best. Now, you know, some other areas, like you were talking about the obesity and the plantar fasciitis, you know, this is a no-fault system, and I don't know how some of these risk factors are going to pan out in the end. I mean, there's a certain implication. Okay, if you're obese, it's your own fault. You could have gone out, could have gotten a gastric bypass, you know, in a pinch or something like that. But, you know, you have people that are like 6'8" tall, and they weigh 350 pounds, and they're not overweight, but they're pretty heavy. You have talk about degenerative arthritis. How many people in their 50s? Or worse still, his 60s, have no pathology. They have no degenerative arthritis. They have no bulging discs. You know, I mean, really, won't we all have orthopedic disability eventually? Should we live long enough? Is there anybody who's 100 years old who has no orthopedic disability? I don't think so. So then you're going to get into, like, civil rights questions, like somebody is going to say, hey, you're discriminating against me for age. Or risk factors. You have, risk factors for heart disease. Studies may show that African Americans have a higher incidence of heart disease. So they're going to let you apportion to race? I don't think so. I mean, all of these things are going to get adjusted by the courts. But in the meantime, you're going to have to deal with them. And when in doubt, make those attorneys pose you specific questions. You do not have to have, and I've seen some letters going out to doctors say, doctor, as you know, they have changed the law on apportionment. Here's a copy of the statute. Please comply with this statute. I mean, huh? You know, if the attorney doesn't know what to do, how are you supposed to know what to do? So that's about all I have to say on I think Glenn's coming up here and sitting is cueing me.
No, there's no cue, but very good.
Okay.
Can I put in one plug for one comment? That'd be okay.
Let me just say, what we'll do now is we'll get some comments here. Then we're going to finish up with those questions on apportionment. Then we have two other great lawyers who are going to discuss some slightly different issues on cumulative trauma. It's another important area, but perhaps not as important as apportionment. We'll have our break, and over lunch, what we're going to do, we have a nice lunch served, we'll have an open mic session with all of the lawyers and Judge Faust involved, discussing, again, specific issues of apportionment. And I'd really like to have specific cases presented by each of you and how to deal with those. Because perhaps as doctors, this is one of the most important things that we can be doing as an AME especially. Okay.
I just wanted to put in one comment to Judge Faust's comment. And maybe I misheard her, but I thought I heard her say, yeah, you're going to have to apply factors of disability both to industrial and non-industrial and then call it speculation. That has a funny ring to it. Wait, before you respond, let me just mention, I think I understand what she meant, but I just wanted to clarify for one moment. I do not believe that newly enacted 4663 requires you to apportion to non-industrial factors. It requires that you consider them. And if I were you, I would address the subject, and if you find factors in the industrial injury, say so. If you find factors other than the industrial injury, say so. But if you find that the industrial injury is 100% of the cause, it's okay to say that. I don't think that was ever the legislative intent. Did I misunderstand what you were saying?
Yes. I mean, what I was trying to say was that you may have some situation where, let's say, you have someone with a really severe, spondylolisthesis and the person's had a rather minor injury, and you honestly believe that spondylolisthesis was a cause, had a causal effect on their disability. But there is absolutely no way under the sun that you could divide up the percentages. And to do so would be speculation. And I'm just suggesting, I don't know how else it can be handled because the statute says you have to do it. I'm not, of course, if there's no factual basis for apportionment, I mean, even now, if I get a case that's clearly subject to new 4663, they didn't make an apportionment determination. But there is no factual basis for apportionment. There's no prior injuries. There's no reason to believe it was anything other than the injury. Then I let that go through anyway. Of course, John is right. You can certainly say 100% industrial injury, zero non-industrial factors. I'm only talking about the situation where you believe that a non-industrial factor did bear a causal relationship to the disability, but there's just no way under the sun that you can assign percentages without speculating. On the other hand, if you think you can assign percentages without speculating, then you should do so, and then you should explain how you assign those percentages.
Let me make one thing very clear. If you're going to do AME work after January 1st, 2004, and you issue a report saying, I apportioned 50-50, but I think that's speculation, you won't be doing it again after January 1st, 2006. It is absolutely critical that you not only give an opinion, but then you justify the basis for the opinion. If you say, my opinion is I'm speculating, then I don't think the concept under the statute is you say an approximate percentage, and you can give you're looking within a range, and you're coming up with your best medical judgment. We're looking at a new dynamic under apportionment. And part of it is we've spent 50 years beating into physicians. You apportion in this fashion, and if you can't say there's apportionment, then you just say there is none. And that was the rule, and we all lived with that rule. And you know, defendants live with the rule, applicant lives with the rule. We have new rules.
You can't do that under this statute. It's the problem.
Well, part of it is that we have to wait till we get some appellate rules on what we're going to do. But if you give opinions and say, I'm speculating, you just won't be doing the business. And that's just the way the reality of it is going to be. My clients are not going to accept it. And frankly, it's not going to help the applicant's bar that much because all that's going to happen is somebody's going to come and take your deposition and say, you need to give us an opinion that you can justify. If the opinion is, I don't think that I can say there's a basis for apportionment, there's nothing wrong with that opinion. That is a perfectly legitimate, valid opinion. Not every case is going to have apportionment. It is still defendant's burden to make apportionment. So, you know, you don't have to go out of your way to create apportionment that isn't there. And I also think, given the levels of disability that we may be describing after the first of the year on the AMA guidelines, people are not going to be as concerned about apportionment as we have been in the past. So there are a number of factors, but you're going to have to give judgment. You're going to have to make an opinion. That's why I say you need to come up with your own framework for how you decide that you're going to make these allocations, weighing various factors, looking at the things that you consider. I just got an opinion from one of my own doctors, with somebody who had a rather significant L5-S1 degenerative disease, and he said no apportionment because, in his judgment, all it really was a lumbar strain, and the degenerative disc disease wasn't playing a significant role. No apportionment. The applicant's doctor apportioned 50% to it. Now, I don't know what's going on. Everybody's going to have to come up with their own rationale on it.
All right. Is there a, given that we're going to discuss cases from the audience at lunch, is there a specific question regarding this apportionment issue that we have to take now or we should take now? So let's take these three and then we'll move along. That'll be it for now, okay, with these questions. Sandy?
Sometimes we see people for AOE, COE evaluation where it's unwitnessed and you're not sure whether it actually happened or not. In that situation, the doctor who does the evaluation will not infrequently say that the decision will have to be made by the famous trier of facts. And I'm wondering who that wise person is, and is that going to be out?
No, that's see, you are here to, you, we need you to decide medical disputes, whether or not they hurt themselves at work or in the park playing soccer on Sunday is something that is beyond your expertise. That's within the province of the judge. So, of course, when you hear, you know, when there is a factual dispute, the only thing that you can do is state what their disability is, their need for treatment, et cetera, which really shouldn't make any difference no matter where it happened, whether they lifted it at work or lifted it at home cleaning out their garage. Same story with legal disputes. If you have a dispute over the going and coming rule because injuries sustained in the course of a normal commute are not compensable, it really shouldn't matter from the doctor's standpoint whether the automobile accident occurred on the way to work or while they were on an errand for the company. You know, it's just not something that you are in a position to decide.
Okay.
So the trier of fact means if the judge decides that they sustained the injury AOE, COE, then this is my opinion, but it would be your opinion anyway, right?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy.
Yeah, thanks. Bob Aptekar. Where does compensable consequence fit into here? When I read 4663, it talks about the direct result of injury. Someone twists their knee, so now they have potentially a contralateral side claim for compensable consequence. They maybe have an RSD claim. They maybe have a psych claim because of the stress that this injury produced. Is that a direct result, and where does compensable consequence come in?
I have no idea. That's a great question, and I address it on page 3 of the handout, and I just say, who knows?
Yeah, there's actually a theory that you will see defendants arguing that while compensable consequences still are entitled to medical care and temporary disability and other benefits, that they will not be entitled to be compensated for permanent disability because they are not a direct consequence of the injury, a direct result. I mean, we'll wait and see. That's obviously a legal issue. You can't decide that. You simply have to give us the information, sure, and we'll go take it to the board.
Could you just define that compensable consequence for those that are not familiar with
it? Compensable consequence is a later developing consequence of the original industrial injury. Certainly one of the common is you have somebody who has a knee injury, the knee is unstable, they're walking down the street, the knee buckles, and they break their arm. That's a compensable consequence. Actually, the most famous case is a guy who had a nucleation of the eye, and as a result of the enucleation of the eye, had a loss of depth perception, and he was using a radial saw at home and sawed off his thumb. And that was considered to be a compensable consequence of the industrial injury because it was an indirect result of the injury.
Dick?
I can tell you, as an advocate for the disabled, my definition of what a direct consequence of injury has expanded largely recently.
Dick?
In deference to Glenn, I wish he'd sawed off his toe. But what I'd really like to...
Start off what?
In deference... I just like to ask, and it's a kind of rhetorical question, but I want to ask it to the legal profession, really, not just you people individually. Do you realize what you're really asking of the medical profession when you suddenly lurch into this documentation of evidence-based decision-making? It is a huge responsibility, because when I go ahead and say to somebody yesterday, the report is beyond the desk today, that yes, this previous fracture of the scaphoid led to an arthritic condition in the wrist, which absolutely, without any question, led to the person's current disability, not in picking up one simple box of shrimp, okay? But to really do that right, I've got to go to the library. I've got to know where that article is. I'm going to pull that article out, which I did do. I'm going to attach it to my report. I'm going to discuss the references, and then you're going to get what you really want. But what we do to give you that takes an inordinate amount of time. And I'd just like to be a little sympathetic about what you're really asking for when it comes to writing that kind of report.
Well, Dick, you know, I'd like to see a show of hands, because that's always a great interest of mine. How many people have actually done what Dr. Braun's saying? How many people here have actually not known the answer to something? And no BS, I wanted an exact answer. Once doesn't count. How many people frequently do this? Have not known an answer to something and actually go to the library or go online to try to research it and take the paper and append it to their report?
Or even if you know the answer, to document.
But a surprising number of 25% of people, I applaud you for that, because that's a huge effort. And that's just, of course, really what you'd want most of all, given the esoteric nature of some injuries. But there are the comments.
I just mentioned to you that keep in mind that the attorneys and the judges in the system are not the people who authored this new legislation that pushes on evidence-based, peer-reviewed, nationally recognized. These are words and phrases that your brothers and sisters in Sacramento, led by their fearless leader, the governor, has cooked up for you and the rest of the system. And, you know, that's a political decision that was made that really has nothing to do, I think, with the people at this panel.
We must go on to our next set of speakers, but let's just get the last comment, and then we'll have plenty of time later and at lunch. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm Oakley Hewitt. One of the things that I always feel under the gun is that the injury was accepted. It was treated under workers' comp, and then you're writing, let's say, an AME report, and you, at that stage of the game, are you really don't think it was a compensable injury, but you've got this huge medical bills and all this treatment. Everybody assumed it was. It's very, very hard to say in your report, you know, I don't think this was a workers' comp injury in the first place.
Don't do it. You are here to resolve disputes, not create them. There is a court of appeal decision where that happened. The applicant and the state fund stipulated to industrial injury. They provided benefits. They went to the AME for permanent disability. And the AME said, you know something? I don't think this was an industrial injury in the first place. It was a cumulative trauma. Immediately, they cut off benefits. See, look. You don't lie. You don't say, but just stay away from it. When you work as an AME or write a medical legal report, you're not functioning as a doctor in the normal sense. The parties are hiring you as an expert witness, and they're hiring you to answer certain questions. And if they don't ask you the question, you know, then don't answer it. So if they don't ask you whether an industrial injury was sustained, you just stay off of that completely. Because
there's a causation section.
But it's causation of disability, not causation of injury. The statute says causation of disability. Well, you know, you have causation of injury concerns if it's a psychiatric case, but not otherwise. At that point, you know, there must be some factual basis for the injury, you know, and whatever happened to this person that they believe was an industrial injury, that's what you consider as the industrial cause.
We'll hear more about this afternoon with Dr. Suhoy and Dr. Mendel. So let's just go on now, because we'll get behind. We're very fortunate to have our next two set of speakers. Thank you very much. Judge Faust, if you could stay up here. Our first is Alex Wong. Alex, you may know the law firm, or probably most of you do, of Jones, Clifford, Johnson & Johnson. Yale Jones has been a frequent speaker at COA events, and now I hope that Alex will continue with that tradition with the COA. We're going to move a little to the side here and to start to discuss issues of cumulative trauma, But because apportionment is so important, I've asked at some point in their talks, Alex and then Dana Miller, who's going to follow from Mullen and Filippi, to make some comments on apportionment issues.
Thank you. Good morning. Hopefully people are still awake, and hopefully I won't change that. Before I get into a discussion about cumulative trauma, I do want to follow up with some comments on apportionment. And I think one of the most important things to remember right now is there is a big cloud of I don't know, and we're all going to give our best opinions and best spins to help you in this period while we're trying to resolve these questions. And it won't be for some time until we have appellate court decisions that clearly tell us what this means, but we can muddle through it as best we can. One of the most important things is explain. Whatever you do, because you're all going to have a slightly different approach on this, and there are going to be two attorneys who have different beliefs and different thoughts. If you can explain how you get to your conclusions and put some detail and thought and analysis into it, we're halfway there, or we're a good part of the way there. There's some contextual things to think about, and we weigh these in this analysis. And I want to start by reminding everyone that the workers' comp system is still a system designed to provide benefits. It's not a system designed to prevent treatment, prevent care, prevent disability, save money. In the end, it's a system that's designed to prevent benefits. And this is a system that was created a long time ago, and there were various trades that happened that reduced liability and payments on some side and reduced the ability to get benefits on the other. So remember that within the context. The second issue to remember is under all of the most recent reforms, there have been several reductions that have been made to the injured worker. The value of disability is changing, and the benefits that are available to the injured worker are changing. So, again, this is a contextual thing. This is not a legal analysis, but this is hopefully to assist in the framework of how you analyze things. When we get to apportionment, I think one of the biggest problems we have, it's a very poorly written statute. The people who wrote it probably did not thoroughly understand how we practice it, and I think some concepts were articulated, and what we have are two warring camps of interpretation. The plaintiffs, the applicant's side, say, gee, you never said pathology. If you meant pathology, you would have said pathology. And there's an old adage when dealing with legislative intent is they mean what they say. From the defense side, it's you wouldn't have changed everything if you didn't mean to change something. And you did some massive changes and got out old sections and put new language in. So clearly there's an intent. And if you didn't intend to do something, you wouldn't have done it. So we both have schools of thoughts and approaches to say what we think we mean. And the problem is the world of unintended consequences. I don't know, and I can't tell you what the legislature meant to do. My gut is that there was concern that it was too difficult to get apportionment, and the goal was to make apportionment easier, but how you do that and to what you apportion and in what cases it's appropriate is all vague. And that's part of what appellate law is going to be, because we're going to have individual cases that go up and we're going to have judges that say, this is what we think they meant or this is what we think is fair. We've had a legal system that for a very long time has honored the concept of the eggshell plaintiff. And the concept of the eggshell plaintiff is you take them as you find them. And someone who is exceptionally vulnerable, who has a very small thing happen to them, is still compensated. Now, with regard to causation, with regard to whether your injury is compensable and falls under the workers' comp system, nothing has changed. So even a very, very small contribution to a very, very vulnerable person is still a work-related injury. And that's a separate discussion than how much disability they get, disability translating into money, and how much of that is the responsibility of the employer or the insurer. And again, that is part of our debate. And so you are going to be asked to weigh these things. I think you do have to use percentages. And that percentage can be 0, 100, or anything in between. And, you know, the example of someone who's walking down, my client who's a police officer who gets shot, I think you're all pretty much going to say that bullet was the 100% cause of that particular injury. In most cases, I'm sure, there are exceptions, but that's the easy one. But you can then say 0% to other factors, and you've addressed apportionment. And you can explain it. And for something that's pretty easy, you can have a fairly simple analysis. One clear, specific incident that clearly relates to the trauma, the injury, and the resulting disability, no other complications, 100% to the work-related injury, 0. What's, of course, much more difficult is that's not your average injury, and you have tons of different injuries. And I'm going to segue into cumulative trauma in a moment. But you need to analyze all of these things. And like I said, we don't know. When we talk about things like obesity or age or any of the other things, silent pathology, the opinion of the plaintiff's side generally is that those things either should not be apportioned to, cannot be apportioned to, or should be minimized. And, of course, from the defense side, it's going to be the other way. It's find every way you possibly can to point to everything else. And in the end, I ask you to think in this global context of how our workers' comp system is designed and that it is a benefits-providing system. An example, and I was having a frank conversation with Mike Marks, who I think stepped out, was the example of someone who is diabetic, who injures their foot, and as a result of a relatively minor foot injury, has to have an amputation. There is a but-for analysis that the applicant side would use, that even though this person is diabetic, they're not having their arm amputated or their shoulder amputated. It was the fact that their foot was injured, and that's the but-for, and that's the cause, and that is the 100% cause of that would be that incident. Of course, there's the countervailing argument that if this person wasn't diabetic, that would have been a cut or a laceration. It would have healed. There would have been no disability whatsoever. So how do you weigh that? And in that case, you're going to have your deposition taken because we're both going to come and approach you. And I have a couple suggestions. The first is you might try two analyses. You might say, look, I don't know if it means pathology or not. I don't know what you mean, so I'm going to give you a couple analyses. And if you're asking for a but-for approach, and the answer is but-for this specific incident, this person would not have had the amputation of their foot under that situation, maybe we have 100% apportioned or 100% attributed to this injury. If I'm allowed to apportion to pathology, then you do this weighing thing. And you say, okay, let's be fair. Let's say that this was not that big, not that huge of a trauma. And let's agree that the diabetes played a role in the need for it. And you assign a percentage. And I can't tell you what that percentage is. I can't tell you if it's 80, 20, 50, 50, whatever. And that's where you have to use your judgment. And if you explain it, you're less likely to have your deposition taken, or we're more likely to understand how you got there. If you simply say 80-20, we're going to be knocking on your door. But I think, again, if you decide, and each of you has to make a decision on what the point of the system is and what benefits are assigned to do and what's appropriate, because the legislature hasn't instructed that. And I don't think there is a percentage that you can scientifically come up with and say we know that 22.6% of this was caused by A, B, or C, so you have to use your judgment, and that's what we're going to ask you to do. With that, I'm going to segue somewhat into cumulative trauma to remind folks that cumulative trauma was not, the labor code section dealing with cumulative trauma was not changed or amended. It's 3208.1. And in layperson's terms, what it says is there are two types of injuries, specific and cumulative. Specific is obvious. You're lifting a heavy box or you fall down a flight of stairs. Those are easy. But in terms of a cumulative trauma, you don't need to have specific injuries. It can be just repetitive work that are microtraumas day in and day out that over time, maybe at no one point needing treatment or causing disability, but over time they wear you down. and that can at some point lead to the manifestation of disability, and at that point you can have a cumulative trauma injury. When it comes to causation, again, we're not talking about disability. Is this a work-related injury? The cumulative trauma laws have not changed. And in the end, we have a system that's designed to make it easier for people who are hurt on the job to get benefits. So I would tell you that the analyses for cumulative trauma is still there, and it really is, did work in some way contribute to this injury. And that's a fairly low bar. Now, once we've established that there is an injury, the next question is going to be apportionment when we get to the end of the road and we talk about disability. And I think specific injuries are easier to argue that there is no apportionment than cumulative, because the whole concept of cumulative injuries are it's a bunch of little things that add up over time. And 9 times out of 10, these little things are not unique to work. If it's weight bearing, you have weight bearing off the job. If it's lifting, you know, you lift things off the job. You live life. You have other factors, age, etc. How is all that going to play? Again, can't tell you. We need your analyses, and it'd be my opinion that since we're within the context of a workers' compensation system, and if we have causation, and if we have a connection that says there is a nexus, a relationship between work and this injury, then at some level you have to do a portion, a hopefully significant portion, connected to work. I don't know what the concept of the eggshell plaintiff is when compared to 4663, the new apportionment language. I think the idea that you could say, yes, this person had a minimal contribution from work, and therefore I have to say it's a work-related injury, but I'm going to apportion 95% of it to pre-existing or external factors or weight or et cetera, kind of runs in the face of what our concept of workers' comp is. And the legislature didn't say do that. It just said talk about causation. And again, we don't know what that means, and we're going to take our various approaches on it. So as doctors, you need to weigh through that, and you have to weigh the role of these things. And again, it's a balancing act, and I think you have to look at what happens on the job, what happens off the job, and if you're and you do need to assign percentages and do your best to explain them. I don't know if that's helped, but that, those are some general concepts on framework. And the more you explain and the more you tell us how you got there, the more it helps us decide whether we need to take your deposition. And if there's a difference of opinions, you may want to give us multiple ideas and then let the lawyers fight it out in court.
Yes. To continue, we have another great guest with us, Dana Miller, who's with the law firm of Mullen & Filippi. We'll continue on these topics. Dana?
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you today. I have to agree with Alex with regards to cumulative trauma. That isn't a real big hot topic in terms of the new legislation. If you have micro-trauma, you're going to have cumulative trauma. There was discussion before the new legislation actually talking about getting rid of cumulative traumas. That never went anywhere, but it does exist. I think what the real issue for you, which has always been the issue, is are we talking about an aggravation versus an exacerbation? You may also want to address the issue of whether the person is symptomatic at work due to a condition, rather than that work actually creating additional cumulative trauma to the underlying pathology, whatever's wrong. So I don't have a lot to say regarding cumulative trauma. I know that we have beat a dead horse on apportionment, but there are a few things that I just have to get in because I can't help myself. First of all, I think a lot of you are looking for pragmatic ideas or considerations with regards to what to do as an AME. I noted a couple of the questions that were asked earlier, and what are we going to do about these? For example, if you're evaluating hands and the person had a prior back injury and disability, what do you do about that? Well, I think as an AME, you have to identify they had the prior back injury. If you identify that they had prior disability relative to the back injury, you need to describe that disability for the back injury. Then you can say, I defer to the trier of fact on issues of overlapping disability. Very pragmatic consideration. You can't leave out important and relevant issues. Another thing I wanted to just point out to you, there's a little two-page handout in your materials which was on apportionment. This is a little kind of consideration list. One of the second page has the apportionment statutes, 4663 and 4664. And as everyone has pointed out, we don't know the firm answers yet. So you, as very educated people, if you're in question or in doubt, read the statute, 4663. We can give you our best estimate of what we think it means, but the reality is that your best estimate at this point is not necessarily going to be anything wrong because everyone could be right. In terms of the gentleman's question regarding the evaluation set in January, what system do you use? Boiling it down, I think what you have to do is if it's a pre-1105 date of injury, look at the letters from counsel to find out, do they want you to use the old system or not? If they don't say anything about using the new system, I would assume you use the old system. Then you're not wasting your time using both systems. If they ask you to use both systems, because that very likely could come up because there's a disagreement on whether PD's been identified before or not, then you do that, but I think that's a reasonable justification for an ML-104. You are entitled to be paid for the work that you do. If you have any dates of injury after 1105, you use the new AMA guide system. Now, this discussion and debate regarding factors. If you look at my little handout, I pointed out some of these other factors that we may consider, and the judges pointed out some in her outline, and some of them overlap with my considerations. But there are a few things that we need to kind of keep in mind. The new system is not going to be based upon disability. Work restrictions, factors of permanent disability are out the window, okay? We are going to be using or evaluating impairments under the AMA guides. Impairments, when you look at the AMA guides and you do your measurements and the ranges of motion and many of the measurements that I can think of, those are based upon or very closely affiliated with what? Pathology. Whether it's industrial or not. So to suggest that the apportionment statute does not include the factor of pathology, in my mind, seems silly. How can you do an AMA impairment, which is establishing lack of range of motion because of fused discs or degenerative disc disease if they didn't have the procedure, and say that none of that is due to the pathology, some of which may have predated? So it's just one of those considerations to keep in mind. Also, just from a political standpoint, I went to the DWC conference a couple of months ago. Judge Kwan was one of the speakers there, and he had mentioned that in talking with some of the legislative aides, is that the original consideration in 4663 about other factors was to put pathology. The word that he got was that the term pathology was too restrictive in considering all other factors for apportionment purposes. So I would at least get to give you a more real-world perception of this. The concept of pathology, I think, is included within other factors, not excluded simply because they didn't use that term. The other consideration in terms of causation, the but-for test. But for the industrial injury, would this person have had this level of disability? Again, I think a lot of that is becoming moot because we do this weird jump from a person who theoretically had no work restrictions, they continue to do their usual customary job as of the date of injury, and then you have to speculatively guess that if they didn't have that, they would have ended up with this level of disability. Again, that's going out the window. We're talking about impairments tied to pathology. Okay. Now, we have this weird transition period between the old system and the new, and we have to live with it, but it's something to keep in mind. With regard to that but-for test, the but-for test goes both ways. But for the industrial injury, they would have this amount of disability non-industrially. The but-for test is this as well. But for the pathology that you see on MRI 2 days after this cumulative trauma is filed, but for this person's weight, but for their diabetes, but for this or but for that, this person would not have had the level of PD they have now. In other words, but for the severe degenerative disc disease at the time the person bent over and picked up the pencil, bending over and picking up the pencil, the direct cause of that injury, isn't going to cause a semi-sedentary level of disability. It might, in the worst case scenario, create a back strain. Maybe that suggests 100% of the permanent disability is apportioned to the degenerative disc disease and zero of the permanent disability is due to the bending over of the pencil. Does that mean they did not have an industrial injury? Absolutely not. It means they had an industrial flare-up or exacerbation of an underlying non-industrial pathology which has reached a level regardless of that bending over for the pencil. We get into a weird conceptual process of using what we are so used to using under the old system and trying to project where we're at with a new system that frankly throws the whole rule book out. There, you know, in the materials you have some case law going back to 1960 and 1980 about apportionment and the like, and the reality is 4663, the apportionment statute, isn't the statute that they're relying upon anymore. We're on a clean slate. So we have to use this statute at face value because we've got new rules. One other final point. The judge was accurate about 4664. If the person has a prior award, let's say it's for the same condition, you may be called upon to address apportionment under 4663. Keep in mind that if you have a subsequent injury, there's more than just apportionment to that prior injury. There might have been the natural extension or progression of that injury's disability. There might have been a natural progression of degenerative pathology due to age or weight or whatever. If you are going to note a prior award under 4664, and then you're going to give an opinion as an AME under 4663 as to what percentage is this and what percentage is that, pull out your calculator and try to make sure that it's consistent with the fact that the prior award existed. So if you have a prior award that was 15% permanent disability, and now your description under the old system brings up to 20%, it's a heavy lifting or whatever, don't turn around and say that only 10% of the overall permanent disability is due to the prior industrial injury. Mathematically, it doesn't make sense. And so I suggest that as a pragmatic consideration to avoid your deposition being set, avoid supplemental reports and like. Finally, with regards to cumulative trauma, we have a new interesting consideration here because 4663 says all other factors. And until we know better, as Alex had pointed out, in a cumulative trauma, if this person weight bears at home or out of work and weight bears at work, then the question is, in a cumulative trauma situation when you're evaluating permanent disability, is that an other factor under 4663 you can apportion to? I would argue that it is because since the applicant now has the equal burden of evidentiary proof, which is now the case under Labor Code Section 3202.5, that's newly enacted, it means that they have the same burden of proof as everybody else. Tie no longer goes to the applicant. They have even burden of proof. The question is that although you can't apportion the medical liability if work created an aggravation, then you owe medical treatment. If non-industrial activities contributed towards that cumulative development of injury, I think you have to apportion by percentages on that as well. And that's all I had to say about that.
That's good. Dana, could you stay there just for a minute? Because we have a disparate audience, some novice, some experts, could you just take 2 minutes to review for us the basic underpinnings of cumulative trauma in the work comp system? The primer, 101 on just cumulative trauma, for those who are not completely up on that. Then what we'll do just after this is we'll take a break. I would encourage you all to take a look at the exhibitors we have. They're very nuts and bolts, practical exhibitors. One is giving away a very nice prize for your business card. And then we'll start up again with Judge Faust at, about 11. We're starting breaking a little early. We'll come back at 11:15. Go ahead, Dana.
Sure. Alex actually touched bases on it. Cumulative trauma is simply the ongoing micro-trauma of doing activities of work that may create a degeneration or deterioration in the function of a particular part of the body. In other words, if a person is typing all day and there's reason to believe that doing that over and over, day after day, leads to the causation or even aggravation of a risk condition, then you have a cumulative trauma. So the rules in California is that as long as work played 1% aggravating role in firing up a pathology or an underlying condition or just a normal anatomical situation and creates the need for medical treatment and or disability, you have a date of injury at that point, and if work contributed to the development of that need of medical treatment or, and or disability, you have a cumulative trauma. There's a lot of case law trying to separate or distinguish what really should or shouldn't be considered specific or cumulative trauma, but from a common sense standpoint, cumulative trauma is when there's not a specific trauma. There's not a significant traumatic event to lead to the need for medical treatment or disability.
And can you just review for us about the dates of cumulative trauma? Often we're asked, is there a second cumulative trauma? What are the legal issues that are involved in that with multiple employers, second cumulative traumas, third cumulative traumas? What are the issues, the main issue we have to take away?
Sure. There are actually different statutes and different case law that address cumulative trauma for different purposes. One might be for the sake of pragmatic considerations, others for the sake of statute of limitations. 5412 identifies the date of injury as the time that the injury created disability and the applicant knew or should have known that it was work-related. That is for statute of limitations purposes. Other case law and statutes identify the date of injury for cumulative trauma as injury that creates the need for medical treatment, not first aid, and or disability. So that would establish the first date in which you have cumulative trauma. Now, there's some case law that says that certain medical treatment isn't significant enough to trigger a date. There's also case law that says that actual time off work is not necessary to establish disability. A modification of your duties at work, self-imposed or medically imposed, may be sufficient. So it is not an easy concept to address. The reason why it's important for you as AMEs is because there's case law that pushes and pulls, and of course we have carriers that may start or stop coverage at certain periods, and you'll be happy to know that there are two cases which the courts keep saying aren't contradictory, but from a pragmatic standpoint sure seem contradictory to me, and that's the Western Growers case and the Coltharp case. Western Growers stands for the proposition that if you have one particular cumulative trauma or a date of injury and the person continues to need medical treatment, and even if they have periods of disability out of that, if the medical evidence suggests that the disability originates from their original date of injury, you don't have a new cumulative trauma or a new subsequent injury, even with disability. Coltharp stands for the opposite proposition, which pretty much says that if a person has disability, then you have a new date of injury, which seems to run at odds with Western Growers. Now, we could spend a lot of time trying to argue and justify how they may harmonize, but the reality is that it's hard. You as an AME need to look primarily at when was the first need for medical treatment, when, if ever, was there need for disability, identify that, and then the push-me-pull you can start between the attorneys, and if they need more help from you, they will definitely come knocking.
Glenn, do you mind if I jump in on one quick comment on
that? Go ahead, and then we'll have time for questions and all these things later and try to come back about 11:15.
There can be a lot of technical questions that come up on dates of injury for cumulative trauma, and it has to do with money. It has to do with which carrier has to pay. Sometimes it's an issue. Sometimes it isn't. The most important thing, and this is going to apply to every one of you on every single case, is please read the letters. I know I've talked to an AME and other doctors who have said, you know, I don't have time to read your three or four page letters. And sometimes you'll see a sort of generic printout in a form letter, and those perhaps mean less. But many a time, the attorneys actually have put some thought into the letter to you, and we ask specific questions. We say, gee, there's an issue here on temporary disability, or gee, there's an issue on the date of injury. Please pay attention to this. We will sometimes bring things to your attention. Look at this report. Look at this deposition transcript. We write these letters for a reason. There is nothing that invites a deposition more than not answering the questions we've asked you. And the reason we've put questions there is for your answer, and if they're not there, you're being told that's not an issue. For example, if it's an accepted injury, we don't want you to tell us, as we said, that you don't think it's work-related. But we do want you to tell us, was the period of temporary disability correct or not, or whatever. So please read the letters, please answer them, and please explain them.
Good. Thank you very much.